moments faded in a world that's been hated.
This is a conversation with Michael Virarti, best-selling author of two books, trainer, speaker, a proud father of three kids, and above all, a dear friend. Michael, welcome to the podcast.
It's great to be here, Philippos. Thank you very much for the invitation.
I'm very happy that the student becomes a teacher and the teacher becomes a student in the context of a podcast.
I consider you both as my teacher and as my student at the same time. So thank you.
It's a conversation that I've been looking forward to have. And I want to take us and the viewers back on a brief memory trip when in 2010, I believe, when I was still practicing law, I was invited to a speech in the amphitheater, the large and spacious amphitheater of the Neocleus Law Firm, where someone named Michael Virarti was going to give a motivational speech. I neither knew Michael Virarti nor what the motivational speech was. So the Mr. Andreas Neocleus gathered around 50, 60 lawyers. And then you came to the amphitheater and you gave us a motivational speech. And I was really interested and puzzled by how a non-lawyer managed to get 50, 60 lawyers on the edge of their seats, like with lovely stories and metaphors and tips on how to become more productive and happy and successful. And then I sent you an email the next day. You also, I think that we also got your book.
Yes, of course. Speech. I remember, yes.
And the next day I sent you an email. I said, Michael, I really enjoyed the talk. It was the first time that as lawyers, we were presented with such a talk. And it struck me that I believe you are, if not the first, one of the first people in Cyprus that brought this new era of professional development interventions in the country, I would say, at least to the extent that you elevated this type of service and profession. Do you have a recollection of those early days?
Of course, I do have a recollection of those early days.
Can you share a few thoughts and memories?
I still remember you on that day. The late Mr. Neocleus came. If I recall well, he bought 100 books of Positive Impact, Thetική Εμπειρία in Greek, the title. And he invited me to address the lawyers at Neocleus. It was a great day, a motivational speech. At the time, I was giving motivational I'm still into motivational speaking, but I don't call it as motivational speaking because you need to educate people, not only just to motivate them. Because as the great Zig Ziglar says, motivation doesn't last, nor does bathing last forever. So you need to get it again. But yes, I do have a recollection. It was a time that the market was a virgin in terms of speaking engagements. Mm-hmm. There were some people, even relatives, asking me, what is this that you're doing? And I believe I created my niche, a niche that I saw in the United States and in Europe, but mainly in the United States. And it was something that resonated with me. It brought that passion out, that enthusiasm out. And that's my recollection of the old good days. Yes.
I recall from our conversation and some interviews that you gave that you yourself actually were enamored and charmed by a speech by Jeffrey Gitomer, I think,
yes,
the sales guru, when you were in the family business, the Virarti family business, and you traveled abroad to receive an award, I think. You channeled your way into one of the speeches or workshops of Jeffrey Gitomer, and this is where I believe, and correct me if I'm wrong, you were enamored, and you saw the allure and the charm of this space of services. Is it a valid proposition?
It's true. I think you used the right words, enamored, allure, and the rest. Yes, that's it. I was working for the family business, our family business, Virarti, and we won a European award in terms of sales. That was a company that I was in charge of, Carlyle Food Service Products. And Carlyle invited us to go to the United States together with my brother to be awarded the European Distributorship Award. We came first in terms of sales. And they hired Jeffrey Gitomer to come and talk to all the distributors, all the Americans, plus two or three Europeans. We were the winners, plus the Italians and some others. And as soon as I saw Jeffrey Gitomer on stage, I was mesmerized. I said, I want to do that. I turned to my brother Giovanni. I said, I want to do exactly what he's doing. So as soon as he completed his speech, which was around 6 hours, it was a workshop speech. It was a keynote together with a workshop. I went straight up to him and I said, sir, how can I become like you? And even though I said the story many times, it's still so vivid in my mind. And he said, I'll tell you the easy way and the difficult way. I said, okay, start with the easy way. And he said, you have to study 2 hours on your chosen topic. Within 10 years, within 5 years, you'll be recognized in your country. Within 10 years, worldwide. This is what Malcolm Gladwell wrote in his book about the 10,000-hour rule, which is not his thesis or his theory, but he brought it, he made it popular, the 10,000-hour rule, that you need to specialize in your topic and mm-hmm. to read in your topic and to be updated and knowledgeable. And then I said, what's difficult? He said, you have to have consistency. Will you be able to do it for the next 10 years, every day, except weekends, I remember, to study on your chosen topic, whatever topic it is, either being a lawyer or a specialized lawyer or a speaker or whatever? I said, yes, sir, I will start today. And I bought his two books and his cassettes, Customer Satisfaction is Worthless, Customer Loyalty is Priceless. And the other was titled The Sales Bible, and his cassettes. And that's how it all started.
That was like 20 years ago?
In 1999.
More than that.
Yes.
Like 25 years
25 ago. Years ago.
And
yes.
I have to say that I truly admire your persistence, because when we came here to record the podcast, you came earlier and I saw you in the car. We were reading and actually actively reading and taking notes in the car. And I saw that's the Michael Viratti I know.
Like, you're very observant. I was highlighting. Yeah. Yes, at the time you came, I didn't notice that you noticed that I was highlighting things.
Because you mentioned the consistency, the advice that you received, that is important to be consistent so as to avoid losing your passion and losing your drive.
And also your edge. There are many people in the industry, and you need to have an edge. You need to be updated, bring the latest examples of what's happening. I mean, if you are just repeating yourself with the same stories, which we all might fall prey to this, then people get bored. And I remember once Elena Tano from, what's the company called? Top Guinnesses. She told me that this person is always repeating himself. So I was a young kid at the time. I was just starting and I said, I made a promise to myself that I shouldn't be repeating myself, even though it's our story. I mean, the Gitomer story, I cannot change the story. I have to tell you what happened at the time because you asked me, I cannot make up another story. But the stories we use in our workshops, the examples, the illustrations, the statistics, the numbers, they do change as the years pass by and as the generations change as well.
I think this has to do with what is known as the novelty bias as well. People have a natural inclination to pursue new information. We have this innate exploratory desire to find out new things, to expand our maps. And this is sometimes a blessing and a curse, because there are, let's say, first principles and primordial lessons and rules that we all need to adhere to. But as you correctly mentioned, even those first principles that are eternal, I believe, for human beings, if you don't manage to repurpose and repackage and wrap them within the package of new stories, new data, new information, then we lose the audience, regardless of whether what you want to convey is timeless. So the key, perhaps, is sometimes to repackage and nest even eternal principles and rules of business or personal development within the wrapping of new stories, new data, new studies, so as to keep renovelizing the conversation and to avoid it from being stagnant and losing the interest of the people.
Yeah.
Is this a valid
proposition? This is exactly what you've done with your book, The Marvel of Happiness. You just repackaged it with everything that you mentioned here. So if we need an example to what you have said, it's the book here.
Yes. So even changing, this, even the, changing no. The cover.
Yes.
And some of the dust or the details or the peripheral characteristics of your message or your service can help do the trick, because we want to align ourselves with the tendency of people to pursue the new always.
Yes. As you said, the novelty bias. I'll give you an example.
Sure.
Just 1.5 months ago, I was delivering a workshop to the dean of students of a very well-known university here in Cyprus, and the administrative staff, the president and the rest. And I said that last night, WeWork has filed for bankruptcy, a company that in 2017, according to Fortune magazine, was the third largest company in the U.S. It was turning $44 billion. Mm-hmm. Last night, it filed for bankruptcy. And they said, are you sure? I don't think so. And it happened last night. It was announced the evening before. And they liked it a lot, and they were researching. And they said, you're right. So if you bring something that happened last evening into play, which I could have used many examples. I could have said about Cyprus Airways being a monopoly and not being in existence today. But that I've said it 10 years ago in 2015 when it happened in January. So now you have to have other examples. And we all go to the same old examples about Blockbusters and the rest. So WeWork was a great surprise for them less than 24 hours after it happened.
And because it was a very recent example, and we have this itch that our curiosity presents to us, we always want to satisfy our curiosity of what's going on now, because what's going on now is more
relevant.
Is more relevant to us and to what we do. So it was a very good idea to do the breaking news type of approach to the conversation. Going back to the family business experience, where you were working for the business, then you went and you watched the Jeffrey Gitomer workshop. But in general, that period in your life when you were in the business, do you recall what were the biggest advantages or pluses of working there versus perhaps some challenges that you were not very content with, like the family business period of your life?
I believe that the family period of my life is the one that is helping me do well today. Because whatever I'm teaching is something that I have experienced through my mistakes, through the challenges, through the hurdles, or through the limited successes, because you remember more the hurdles than the successes at the end of the day. But yes, there was something inside me telling me that I needed to break from the 9-to-5 work week. I wanted to do what I'm doing today, delivering leadership keynotes and workshops and the rest. But I think the school, the university, was the family business, because I've tried everything there. I started as a delivery person for 3 years. Then my father told me to move on to sales. But sales were happening all the time, because it wasn't about selling. It was about winning the trust. And you can win the trust in whichever position you are in the company, as long as that you are loyal, as long as you respect the other person you have opposite you, as long as you deliver on your word, then they will come back and they will ask for more if you're consistent. If you're consistent, it's very important. And that was my university, to be honest, and the university on wheels as well, in my car listening to Jeffrey Gitomer's tapes. And I remember, I also said in another podcast, he had his 101.5 rules for success. And I was listening to them in my car whilst driving. And people would see me weep. I was weeping. And because they thought I was going to a funeral, but I wasn't going to a funeral. I was enjoying what I was listening to. And I said, this is how you build your legacy, your empire, your sales, or your company, your organization, you take it to the next level. And his 101.5 rule for success was the following. Jeffrey Gitomer said, you're given a bucket of water and a bucket of cement. You can either build a stepping stone towards success or a stumbling block. The choice is yours. So I always made it a point to build a stepping stone, not a stumbling block, towards success. And that's the story in a nutshell.
It's very interesting to note that essentially, whilst you were in the professional environment of the family business and engaged in sales and the organizational and operational affairs of the business, at the same time you were preparing or grooming, let's say, yourself for the future and for your future aspiration. And that interplay between having one foot in the actual organizational reality and the second foot in what it is that you want to create or pivot into always strikes me, because it's easy to get driven or follow the allure or the rabbit hole of doing something very fascinating and exciting like speaking, training, and the type of business that, well, we both do, but you've been doing for much longer. One of the traps, I believe, is to follow that path, that teacher sort of path or that trainer sort of path, without having a solid foundation in the actual business world. And I believe that it's a trap, because if you become a teacher in a domain that you have not collected pertinent experience in, you fall into the risk of teaching stuff that you are not or you have not been accountable for. And teaching is easy, and regurgitating information, recycling information is easy. But the problem is that if you don't have personal experience from personal exposure or from actually working in a proper environment like a family business or a law firm like me, I find that it's a problematic path, not only for the clients that you may be advising without having a solid foot into the industry that you speak about, but also for yourself. So do you think that this need to have one foot firmly planted in actual work experience in the domain that you want to teach or train is important, and how important for someone who wants to pursue the line of services that we do?
First of all, I like the way you recap things, and you gave a vivid image, and I've seen that image whilst you were talking. You said you have to have a solid foot. It's true, you have to have a solid foot so your customer can have solid food with ND in their plate. And very important is for the master to be once have been a student. Mm. And you have to immerse yourself in whatever you're doing. And I think once we were talking together, I said, Philippos, you're very gifted. You can do many things. And I take my hat off to you for choosing this path. But have in mind that your biggest advantage is that you were once a lawyer. So coaching for lawyers, helping lawyers, because you've been there, you've done that, you've got the T-shirt as the Pepsi advertisement used to say, will give you an added advantage over any of us who haven't been lawyers, who are asked from lawyers to go in and advise them. So you can advise in the business world, but you can also see their pain and feel their pain because you've been through their pain, which is very important. So yes, the family has groomed me. The family business has groomed me for what I become. But you are as good as your last performance, as they say in theater. So we need to keep on grooming ourselves, even if we're not currently active in the family business. So that's why I have a lot of meetings, or I do talk to a lot of people, and I am being mentored by a lot of CEOs or different other people who work in the industries that I would like to influence, asking them about their challenges, about their pains, about anything that comes in their way, about how they see the future, how they see the different generations, how they deal with the different generations. So that's my way of keeping my foot solid on the ground in the industries that I would like to influence and impact. And I have a friend, Lahad Zvi. He's a very successful consultant in Israel and also a global consultant as well in terms of sales B2B. And he always sends a questionnaire to the various industries that he would like to get into. He's impacting three industries, from high tech to various others. And he always asks them, what are the three most important challenges that you have? And he sends this out to 60 CEOs. Mm-hmm. So he gets answers, and then he places everything together, and he goes to other CEOs or to the same CEOs and says, guys, I know what are your top three challenges. And if you would like to solve these top three challenges, I can help you do that. And 8 times out of 10, most CEOs call him back and say, you nailed it, my friend. That's exactly what's puzzling us, what's on the top of our mind. And yes, do come in and help us. So
he has his finger on the pulse of the industry.
Exactly.
He knows the real issues.
He press enter with his finger. The survey goes, so he keeps his finger on the pulse, yes.
Do you mind sharing with us what are the three key challenges, perhaps not in the case of your friend, in general, that you see for leadership? It's a topic that is very interesting to me. Perhaps in Cyprus, to narrow it down.
We can.
Or you can generalize it.
Yes.
If you want. The biggest three leadership challenges, yes, that you have encountered.
One of the challenges that I believe you might have encountered as well, or our customers have encountered, is the different generations and how they go about making life interesting for them, keeping them intrigued in the business. Because I don't like to box people, because I might be 50 years old. No, I am 51 years old, but I might not have any children. I might act like a millennial, for example, or a millennial might have given birth to 3 children, and he might be thinking like I'm thinking now, or how we are thinking in terms of having safety for our children, insurance, different needs, running. So I don't want to box people, but the different generations act in a different way, have different demands. Mm. I remember just a few days ago, we had a workshop, and the HR manager said, in the old days, when I was at the other hotel, whoever came with a tattoo in their hands, they were immediately disqualified without even telling them anything. Today, I don't look at CVs as much as I used to in the past, or educational criteria, whatever. I don't care if they have a tattoo or not. Mm-hmm. And it's different things that I'm asking to reach a decision. But in the old days, they were just cancelled as soon as they walked in with a tattoo, within 10 years, how things change. And each generation has different demands. So, for example, I was talking to one of my customers, and I said, for this guy who's very gifted, give him ownership. And he said, what do you mean? Give him shares? No, don't give him shares. Give him ownership. Give him a project, responsibility. Give him responsibility for that project, and tell him what to do. Don't tell him how to do it. Mm-hmm. And he will surprise you most probably with his ingenuity. So by doing this, immediately, not only did he gain his loyalty, he helped him a lot in coming up with something that he wouldn't have come up with. And that person is still in the company, and the CEO is very happy. He's very happy, and I'm very happy that I advised him the way I did. Other leadership challenges that I see is that the world is constantly evolving. Mm-hmm. What happens in one part of the world, conflict, war, inflation, and the rest, impacts everything else. Like now, what's happening with the hoodie, and the ships have to take a different turn. Everything, we are influenced and we're impacted by whatever happens around the world.
The VUCA effect.
VUCA effect. And it's a very volatile world. And we're impacted. I was watching recently one of the Indian gurus, I forget his name, and he said, we're living in difficult times. The Russian lady asked him, we're living in very difficult times. And he said, no, to be honest, I think the problem is interconnectivity. What do you mean? She said, because in the old days, somebody used to die, 10 people used to die in that part of the world, you never heard about it. Because they lived through different, through a lot worse things that we did. For example, the Spanish flu killed millions of people, nothing compared to COVID, the Spanish flu. They lived through 2 world wars. We haven't lived through a world war in our generation. So it's the interconnectivity. But this interconnectivity impacts everyone. So I believe CEOs or C-level executives should be aware of what's happening around the globe. And it's not only a local thing. It's a global phenomenon that's impacting them. And last but not least, which is a lot more, from what I've what I see is that in the old days, it was an advantage to stay at a company for 40 years that showed loyalty. Today, my HR wife told me that if I'm going to hire someone, I want to see that he has worked in two or three places, he has gained experience. So if I see in the CV that he has moved three or four places and he has stayed for 3 or 4 years, it shows that he's consistent or she's consistent, and she has learned how to deal with different things from different companies with different mentalities in different parts of the world or in Cyprus, whatever, doesn't matter. So nowadays, loyalty has come down to 5 years instead of 40 years. So I would come back to the advice my father gave me just before his death. Nothing in life is too big not to fail, and nothing in life is permanent. So nothing in life is permanent, my friend, nothing. So we have to understand that we cannot plan 10 years or 20 years in advance in terms of our business scope. We have to look at things in the medium to short term. We have to be agile and resilient, of course, adaptable, knowledgeable, not only in our country, but globally. And last but not least, we have to understand the different generations because different generations have different demands. And according to Deloitte, by 2025, 75% of the workforce will be millennials. So it's better to immerse ourselves and learn what makes them tick.
So many great points. I have four possible directions to take the conversation, but I have to economize on time and focus. So I will start with the point on your father. I know that you are keen and you are quite wise to do so, to share stories and proverbs and advice pieces by your father. Why do you think many people are disinclined, especially the young generation, are disinclined to listen to their parents or to listen to the elders nowadays? Because I am with you completely that we need to accommodate and be wise enough to listen to those who are wiser than us, especially the older generations, like and people who worked like your father, who have accumulated a vast amount of wisdom around life and business. Why do you think that there may be a disinclination of people to take fatherly advice? I have my views, and I want to chat with you about it.
Yes. First of all, I have to tell you that you had a very nice first episode, if I'm not mistaken, with Mariana Prokopi Dimitriadis. Yes. And when Mariana said, I will give you an advice that my father said, and she showed her two fingers, I leaned forward to listen to your podcast. And I said, whoa, somebody talking about their father. I don't see this very often. So I believe that you might be correct with what you have said. Now, to break it down, because I've never thought of this, because I always mention my dad and sometimes my mother's advice and people who are close or even my brother's advice. I believe what my father has done to me is that he gave me an advice that helped me listen to his advice. The advice was the following. He said, Michael, look, even if you disagree with someone or even if you don't like to hear what they want to say, remain calm. Don't close your body language. Mm-hmm. Let them finish. First of all, if they're mistaken and you're sure they're mistaken, don't do anything. Don't do nothing. If they're right, or if you think they might be right, listen to it, absorb it, think about it, encourage them to speak with your body language, as you're doing now, and think about what you want to do in the future. Because if they're right, you can improve. What I see today, with raising three children, having a millennial wife, having friends of different ages, is that people are rushing to give you an excuse why you're wrong or why they disagree with you. So if you do that, not only do you kill that idea at that same moment, but you kill all the other ideas that would have come your way from that particular person because they killed it. Imagine if I tell you about your workshops and I say, Philippos, you can improve your workshops by doing one little thing. You say, Michael, no. Look, listen, no. It's not exactly what you've seen in my video or what I've posted. So I will never give you an idea again. It's finished. Because you never let me finish, I might be wrong. But if I'm wrong, you have nothing to lose. Continue on your path. So the reason I believe why I'm so receptive is because, first and foremost, I respected my dad, and I've seen results from my dad, both in business and in life. I've seen his advice work, but I've seen his advice work because I wasn't defensive. He managed to break down this barrier, probably with his words and the way he has raised us, my brother and myself, so I could listen to the advice. So I believe this is it. But also, I would like to hear your opinion, because you said you have
You mentioned about the intergenerational fabric of the workplace and the various generations of people that are now occupying businesses and jobs. I believe that we live in an era where, and this is a big topic for discussion, where social institutions are breaking down, okay? Now, I don't want to sound like somebody who is from a different generation completely, but there is an overemphasis in freedom today, in rights, okay, in expanding our rights, both in our private lives and in the workplace. And this is why this erosion of tradition and this overemphasis on liberties and freedom leads to an inevitable disinclination of us to listen to the agents of tradition. Who are the agents of tradition? The elders, our parents, our fathers, and that's why I believe we are also seeing a difficulty in people working in companies and adhering to rules and procedures, which are also a form of tradition, if you think about it. So this overemphasis on individual freedoms and this disinclination to listen to the wisdom of the previous generation, whether it's the father or the leader or the manager who's been around for much longer than us. So this break in tradition, this break in social institutions, and this overemphasis on individual freedom in society has also trickled into the workplace, and it is for this reason that we find it difficult for people to align and integrate well into workplaces and to adhere to procedures and rules.
But can I ask you something?
Sure.
What isn't it? Some traditions are not up to date, and
of
some
course.
Things have to change.
Absolutely.
Isn't it people like these people who have managed to break these traditions and open our eyes to new, more innovative practices or different ways of thinking? So where is it that we should deal with the agents of tradition and listen to them? And where shouldn't we listen to the agents of tradition?
That's the million-dollar question.
Yes.
And I like the way that you rephrased the conversation. And so there is this tension between the need for stability. Tradition is a form of stability. It's a code. It's a language.
True.
Right?
True.
This is what
it speeds up things as well, that's the way we've done it.
Exactly.
Yes.
So tradition, whether in the social space or in the workplace, in terms of the traditional policies and procedures, it's the same conversation. So on the one hand, we have the need for stability or the need for tradition, interrelated concepts, and then the other end of the tension is the drive for innovation and change. So my proposition is that if you overemphasize or if you stay in the space of tradition and stability and you become blinded to what's outside of you and you become misaligned from the ever-evolving world that you mentioned before, because the world constantly shifts, whether the economy, the environment, the social landscape, everything changes. So if you lock yourself in the cabinet of tradition and you fear making the changes that you need to do to replenish the system or the organization or yourself, you keep on the edge of knowledge, then you risk stagnation and being too rigid, and things and people and organizations that become too rigid collapse, like Kodak or the typical names we mentioned before, we are great the way we are, we know everything, we don't need to change, and this will lead to ossification, like you become too rigid and you crumble. Yes. On the other end, though, if you are overindulgent and you over focus on the innovative or the exploratory drive just for the sake of change. And because change has a stronger allure, even in politics, those who promise change, change is a better story. It has a more positive and mesmerizing storytelling to it than let's keep the system. You know, let's see, keep the system is a bit, people think it's out of fashion. But if you say let's change everything, this has a rebellious flavor to it. So if you advocate for change just for the sake of change, or even worse, if you advocate for innovation and change, but you fail to have one foot firmly planted in the reality, as we said before, like, and you allow things that are of value to perish, or you abdicate, or you replace, or you cancel, or you render obsolete those, let's say, traditions or values, or in the workplace, systems, policies, and procedures that are necessary simply for the sake of change, then you running to the opposite end of rigidity, which is disintegration. Think about the example last year of this submersible, the Ocean Gate Titan, like this guy, a true adventurer. The owner, I don't remember, he stole something. What did he do? So let's look at the tradition versus innovation interplay in this context. You have on the one end the industry of submersibles, where follow quality rules. You build a submersible using this ISO standard. The hull has to be titanium and some a checklist that with a myriad of things. You know, like, this guy said, no, you know, I'm going to abolish this traditional requirement that the hull has to be titan, and I'm going to employ carbon fiber hull. Excessive innovation, untested, imploded, disaster. Yes. So my answer, to finish with my rant, I believe that there has to be a delicate dance between the need for stability / tradition / in the workplace procedures, policies and systems, and drive for innovation. So we cannot disregard either of these poles of this polarity. That's my...
And just to sum it up, if someone who gives you advice, you've seen it working on them or... then you will follow it. If you want to be blindsided, or if you don't want to be blind, instead of not following the advice, that's it. I saw my father's advice working. I saw it in the family business. I saw it at home. I've seen it with other people. And I said, at the end of the day, I want to follow this. We need to look for mentors at whatever age. It doesn't matter if they're older, younger, more educated, less educated. You look at, as Anthony Robbins has said, success leaves clues. Very if you want to follow the clues, follow them. If you don't want to follow them, average is more than anybody else. So you will be average if you're only on your own and being reactive to any advice that you get. Average is what you pay. That's correct. The price you're paying.
And also, I think one of the reasons that we don't listen to our parents or the our fathers or our elders is the novelty bias again we discussed before, because what do they know? Let's look for the new advice, the new thing. But we lose, we become blinded to timeless pieces of wisdom like the Tony Robbins, success, lose clues. So if you think that the clues there are outdated, you become blinded to what you need to do to succeed as well.
And if you ask, who are you to tell me? It's finished. It's done.
Tony Robbins is too old.
Yes.
So whatever he says is canceled. Yes. That's not how it goes. And okay, going back to the idea of what should someone do to get into this space of speaking, training, and workshops. Do you think that there is a viable market in Cyprus for this? For people to leave their job and get into this industry?
Okay. I can't speak for any industry, but let's speak for this industry in particular. there is always a market.
Mm.
Because the market shouldn't be only Cyprus. For the one entering, he or she should think that the world is their oyster. Mm-hmm. It shouldn't be only Cyprus. Last three inquiries I got were from Greece, which is not Cyprus. Mm-hmm. They speak Greek, but it's not in Cyprus. So you need to think of a bigger market, of a bigger dream, not only just the Cyprus market. But if we go to the first part on what they need to do, if success leaves clues, and if Michael Berardi was coming into this industry today, mm-hmm. I would do the following. First of all, I would study the people. I'm not going to say competition, because I wouldn't have competition, because I'm just starting. I would study the people that have made it, in inverted commas, mm-hmm. the people who are successful. See what they do. If podcasting is a successful thing to do, I might think about it. Mm-hmm. I will prioritize and look at it. Then I would go to someone and say, look, how much should I pay you to show me the steps, to show me how I can do it? Can I sit with you to see how you prepare a keynote? Can I sit with you to see how you set up a workshop? Can I look at one of your proposals to see how you write and how you talk about an investment instead of a price? Why do you write investment and you don't write price? Why do you leave the investment at the end and you don't put it at the beginning? Why is your first proposal with never an investment in there? Because it's in there without the investment. Because if they reject me, I will know they reject my proposal, not my price. Because if I have the investment and the proposal and they reject me, I don't know which one they are rejecting. Is the price too high? Or I didn't nail the proposal, I didn't understand their needs. Whereas I send two. The first, I send my proposal. They say, yes, Michael, that's it. But where is the cost, the price? Which they never call investment. I said, oh, no, first of all, I wanted to see if this is what you needed. Mm-hmm. So as soon as they need that, then I will send it within the day, within the hour, within the minute, because I have it ready, with investment. So they said yes to the first place, to the first one. Then there might be a no. I know they're rejecting the price. I don't mind. But if they say yes, it's the encyclopedia way of selling. Yes. Do you believe in knowledge? Yes. Do you believe in reading? Yes. Do you believe in having a better future? Yes. Would you like to buy an encyclopedia? You know, it's a yes, yes, yes. But anyway, I would find a Philippos Aristotelos, a Michael Virardi, a Savas Trichas, and ask them, how do you do this? How do you do it? And look at the procedure. And I would pay for it. I would invest. I would invest to learn from the best in Cyprus or in the world. And if you don't want to invest in it, you're not investing in your future. And that's how I would do it. Also read books, also study podcasts. Also, whenever Philippos Aristotelos mentions a great book, I would buy it immediately. Not I would wait for it to win it in a competition. I would buy it and I would be reading. I would be doing my push-ups every day to get myself ready. And I would trust my mentor as I trusted my dad. In the very first attempt, I remember, I went to, it was Epifaniou company here in Cyprus. They said, how much is it, son? At the time, the late Miranda Sideras used to charge £500. The other gentleman from TMI used to charge £500 for a speech. My dad told me £1,500, Cyprus pounds. And I said, £1,500. He said, son, do you know that your competition is charging three times less than you? I said, yes. Why should I pay three times more? Because I was preparing for 10 years to do this thing, and I'm ready to do it. And if you don't like it, I will give you your money back. He said, son, where have you spoken before? This is my first gig. So he threw me out of his office. Ethniki Insurance came. Christos Christodoulou came. He hired me. He says, I see something in you. How much? 1,500. The next year, Epifaniou came, and they hired me at the Mediterranean Hotel, a few meters down from here. 1,500, I gave my first keynote. And from that moment on, it was 1,500 Cyprus pounds. It was never 500. And I'm going to go, I have to find a mentor to mentor me how to do all these things. That's what I would have done. And also have belief in it. My first gig came after 7 years in Cyprus. Now it won't come after 7 years. It might come after 5 or 4 or 3 or 2. Because YouTube and the rest and the information that's online is speeding up our progress, but you need to find a mentor. I would have found a mentor.
The price dilemma is one that I believe bothers or should bother everyone in this industry. And we had this chat many times before. And you also helped me tremendously when I began doing workshops and seminars, where the first piece of advice, if you allow me to say it.
Yeah, please, go ahead.
Was be careful where you position yourself, because where you position yourself is where more or less you will be positioned.
You're going to end up.
Ending up there. It's not like you pull up some levers and you keep changing the price, because that's not how things work. And that came from experience. And how do you solve the price dilemma? And another sub question is this. Okay, let's say if I push the prices too high, I don't get any projects, but I know that this is where I want to be. If you place the price too low, you will get projects. Perhaps, not perhaps, surely you will also get experience and learning. But then you lock, in inverted commas, yourself in a specific price space. So is this dilemma solvable? You gave a hint before, because you started from a specific 1,500 pounds. But for somebody who is starting out, let's say now, what's the right way to solve this this riddle?
Like with everything, Philippos, you have to test. You have to test. First of all, you have to do an audit, a self-audit. Mm. And because we're not that, we are biased and prejudiced, you have to ask other people. There was a lady that came recently, a very nice lady, educated lady. She said, I want to start doing coaching. Mm-hmm. I want to have very low prices and also give some complimentary to get into the market. And I said, who said that with low prices and complimentary you get into the market? Why don't you invest your time to do micro content, place it on the web, and then get people interested in what you're saying, so you have them calling you instead of you calling them? It's like hunting and fishing. If you go hunting, you're trying to kill the prey and the prey runs for their life. If you go fishing, you throw the bait. The bait is the micro content. One of the examples, I have many examples, but if you look at Murat Oğlu, the tennis coach, he's so successful. Why does he do micro content explaining how to play tennis in a way that will make you a better tennis player? Because at that time, you would say, I want to go to Murat Oğlu's academy. I want to send my children to Murat Oğlu's academy because the guy is amazing. He's a genius. He's giving us a glimpse into his own world. And he's giving us advice. And I have many to tell you about that they're doing micro content, from dentists to Murat Oğlu. So at the end of the day, I would have shifted all my energy and my power. I would have run another 20 podcasts and get micro content. When you were saying about the politicians, that if they promise change, then this or that, whatever appeals, whatever can give value to the world, to your audience, project it. And let the audience come to me. That's one way of solving your price. Because if you pick up the phone and you call the customer, or if you knock on their door,
cold calling,
mm-hmm. It's good, but they are in charge and your price has to be lower. If you get them to call you, then it is a different ball game. So patience plays a role. Having an audit and being real and talking to people, getting them to analyze you and tell you, what am I doing right? What am I doing wrongly? Ask somebody like Philippos or somebody who's more experienced than us to tell us. People would love, or most people would love, to give you their 5 cents and their wisdom. But you need to ask. And then we go back to your other question. Why don't people look up to their parents? If they don't look up to their parents or to the traditional advice or to people with wisdom, and then how will they look up to strangers? And how will they listen to strangers? So at the end of the day, no man or woman is an island. You need support. That support, you do it. You need to use your 2 years. You need to use your resilience. You need to do audits all the time, and also understand what differentiates you from the rest. If you cannot answer what differentiates you from the rest, if you cannot answer this question, then why would they hire you if you cannot answer it yourself?
Which leads me to another question before we move to the personal sphere and some things we have in common. The connected question to the differentiation remark is this niche versus generalization or generic appeal, another dilemma. So like niche, should I be coaching lawyers only for me now? Should I be doing workshops and consulting for law firms only? Or should I expand my net, my fishing net, to move into other fields like accountants? So in the periphery of law, or should I expand it much wider and move into other industries as well? So the more, and we live in Cyprus, despite that we should be aiming globally. So the more niche you become, the more specific your ideal client, but at the same time, the more you exclude prospects from your consideration. Have you considered this?
That's exactly what I would have answered. You answered it yourself.
Niche versus generic.
I mean, whenever I am in Greece and I'm driving to go to the airport, or I'm going through areas that are businesses are there. Honestly, in Cyprus, we have 5, 6, 10 big companies. There, they might have thousands of companies that can hire you. We are a very small place. Mm. If you stay only in Cyprus, then you cannot niche. It's not easy to niche because there are 10 law offices, bigger offices that can hire you, or they can afford you, and it's not enough. And once you work with one or two, maybe some others might not want to work with you because it's a small place. Mm-hmm. So as long as you have a plan of, that's why I was always doing podcasts in English, writing books in English, taking out my material in English, going on to TikTok, and I wasn't doing well at the beginning. And people telling me, Michael, switch to Greek, gather some audience, and then you switch to English. I said, no, I want to aim for an 8 billion global audience. Mm-hmm. I don't want to aim for 500,000 plus the Greeks, 10 million audience. I want to aim for an 8 billion audience. And then I translated my books into Greek. I wrote them in Greek, but I was talking only in English. And then I translated them into English as well. But at the end of the day, I had, since 20 years ago, I had something in mind, the world, not only Cyprus, the world. And if your phone rings, not only from Paphos, Larnaca, Nicosia, and Limassol, if it rings from all over the globe, then you have an advantage, my friend, to command your pricing, to be able to niche, and that's how you do it. So we talked about baby steps for beginners. We talked about experienced people. So people need to go through the whole
self-audit process
and through the whole process to get there. Because we talked about two different types of trainers.
So the world is my oyster then.
Yeah, the world is your oyster.
If you want to niche, especially.
Philippos, the world is your oyster, especially if you want to niche. If you're staying in Cyprus, when I was only in Cyprus, I couldn't niche.
So if you stay in Cyprus and you want to make this your full-time job and to sustain your family as well, it's the next point in the podcast. How do you do it? Like, do you become an expert in leadership, sales, customer service, communication? Is it even plausible for a trainer who says or who promotes him or himself to be great in all these domains, to be actually great in all these domains, the opposite of the niche?
Yeah.
So can you do everything?
The wisdom of the masses will expose you. People know. I know when I watch trainers talking about a certain topic, if they were immersed in the topic, I know immediately. I know who is reading books and finding proverbs in there and just throwing the proverbs, and they're trying to convince people that they are leadership experts. I know it. I know it. And we go back to our beginning conversation, something that you said that I liked very much. If you have your foot solidly grounded in that industry, in that niche, in that area, in that specializational topic, then keep talking about it and you will command your niche, your pricing, and your future. If you don't, become a philosopher of everything, talk about everything, and something will stick. But you will never have loyal customers following you year after year. You will never command your pricing at the rate that you want it. And you will always be shifting, thinking that it's the world that has a problem and your customers that don't understand, but it's you. It's not the world. It's you.
That's a very good point, actually. So you become resentful once you...
It's the attribution theory. We attribute our success to ourselves. We attribute our failure to the situation. That's it.
It's in the book as well.
Yes.
It's in the book.
Yes.
One version of it is in the book. Yes. Before I moved into the personal space question...
My favorite space.
Of course. The same here.
Talking about family, not personal.
It's the... You mentioned about the niche and the having one foot in a specific experiential domain. And I know that you managed, that's my opinion, to break into the notoriously difficult hotel industry, which is very difficult to enter for as a trainer or a speaker, because the hotel industry is very unique in its needs and requirements, its seasonality. And I know that you are doing some really hard work and you are gaining some really remarkable projects. If you can distill the secret of how you managed to enter that industry as a formidable player, what would it be?
First of all, I was in this industry, supplying this industry from Virardi, our family business, which deals with catering equipment and tabletop supply. So a whole lifetime, I started from the warehouse,
different
delivering
cup.
The goods, different cup, and I know it inside out. I don't know. I'm not an expert in how you serve wine and the rest, but I know the industry because I was talking to the FMB. I was talking to the general manager. I was talking to everyone within the hierarchy, for the housekeepers, because our slogan at Virardi was the complete hotel supply company, which I changed because, as I told my late father, you cannot be everything for everyone and still be the best in your industry or one of the best. So everyone would come to us for anything they required. So we were losing a lot of time. We had a lot of products. Mm-hmm. We couldn't specialize ourselves. So we changed it to the slogan, Obui biodita stihizi ligotero, where quality costs less, because people were accusing us that our prices were very high. And it's good to accuse you that your price is high. It's even worse if they say that you are not an honorable person. So we came with where quality costs less. So at the end of the day, you will have it for a longer time. I don't know who says that, but one of the biggest, I think it's Antonella, what is it, Versace, who says,
Coco Chanel.
Coco Chanel, who says that price, quality will remain long after price is forgotten.
Yeah.
So it's very important. So there is no secret in terms of that. I believe I was doing a good job talking about various things that had bordered with the hospitality industry through my micro content. Somebody picked it up, or in the case of Park Lane, let's say the case of Park Lane. I went there for holidays with my family. As soon as I walked in, the general manager of Park Lane, Yannis Stefanou, told the HR manager, Pagona Lingu, get Michael Virardi to come here. We need him for trainings. If they needed me for trainings, they would have contacted me before I went there as a guest. But what happened? Yannis Stefanou was one of the managers, not the top manager, but one of the managers at Costa Navarino. Because I believe I did a good job at Costa Navarino in Greece, Yannis Stefanou said, this is our guy, bring him in.
So you are only as good as your last gig.
As your last gig. So if I didn't do a good job at Costa Navarino, he would never have asked his HR manager to bring me. As soon as I went there, and as you said, branding is part of the process, we took a photo and we placed it there. Another hotel came, Deluxe Hotel, 5-star in Peia Paphos. They said, can you come in? As soon as I came there, then the Four Seasons came. We booked with them. And now I'm talking with one of the biggest hotels in the world that I adore a lot and hope I nail this one. But you will nail it not because of your price. You will nail it because of the work that you have done with others, and people are talking to each other and exchanging. Some belong to the same group. For example, Marriott has lots of hotels around the globe. So there is no secret. The only secret is become relevant, niche yourself as much as you can. It was very difficult in Cyprus. It took me 15 years to manage to do this. And never stop reading, never stop believing that, or never become enamored with your success and say, I'm the best. If you say you're the best, you're not the best. And you will never be the best. What I say is that I know how I differentiate myself from somebody else. And sometimes I might not be the one that they should hire. And I'm honest in that respect and say, this is not my area. And they do respect it at the end of the day because I send them to somebody else.
Jeff Bezos in Amazon recently, he was on the Lex Fridman podcast, I think his first appearance on a podcast, and he mentioned that in Amazon, they have this day one policy.
Yes, I love this day one policy.
So the day one policy, very briefly, is a mindset and it's a way of being which aims to avoid the pitfall you have described, which is I made it. So let's automate everything, let's relax. Day one thinking is the idea that, going back to the tension between innovation and stability, we always need to feel that we can improve things, so we can expand and grow. And that's a mindset of never succumbing to the comfort of or complacency of your success, because the law of entropy will basically crash you. True. You will stay behind.
True. Day one. I read his books. I read one or two of his books, and that's one of the two things that I kept. The day one was one of the two things that I kept, yes.
And before we, that's the last question, before we enter into the podcast studio, we were having a chat outside, and we said how being both fathers of three kids places a bigger sort of responsibility on our shoulders, but I think we agreed, you can let me know what you think, that ironically the bigger the burden on our shoulders, the more the drive and the energy in pursuing what it is that we love, because we have a valid purpose to become better at what we love. So I want to close the conversation with some thoughts on the eternal and always fashionable point of life balance. Do you have some thoughts on that?
Okay, it's two things.
It's two, the kids, the family, the responsibility, and the balance. Let's stick with the first one.
The first one.
Yeah.
Okay, if we can provide a picture for your audience to understand, if we go back 20 years, it's Michael Berardi sitting in an apartment with one plate.
And his ambition
with one plate empty.
Yes.
Now I have six plates around the house with the kids, with Christine, myself, our housemate who's helping us because we are both working.
You have a dog as well.
We have a dog.
Seven plates.
Yes, seven plates. Yesterday I was buying dog food and Rolando said, "Dad, what is this receipt, 80 euros? I said, "This is a dog food, my friend. Two packs, 40 euros each, 80 euros. He said, "Unbelievable. He's costing us more money than we." So, yes. So now envision this. We have a responsibility to our family to provide in whichever way. Provide food, knowledge, advice. We have to provide
safety,
everything, especially in today's world. Bravo, safety. And the second, and that responsibility, in my case, and I believe in your case as well, it has helped us a lot to prioritize. I was very romantic with income and the rest, and money wasn't my thing. But now I know that I have to provide for my family. And there was a research that came out from the Cyprus government, thank God, because I don't keep an Excel on my expenses. And I saw that if you have three kids in Limassol, it's 4,583 euros per month. So if you go to the bank to ask for a loan or whatever, they will tell you it's 4,583 starting, if I recall well. So that's your expenses for a month if you have three kids.
Yeah.
So what's your income showing? So whatever we do,
it's good.
It's good that I saw that for starters. And you said about work-life balance. Once I gave a workshop at the Four Seasons Hotel for a company, I don't remember which country it was, they flew in. They told me to give them a workshop on work-life balance. And I immediately told them that the workshop will be titled Work-Life Fit, because it never balances, it fits. Mm. It never balances. It might be unbalanced one way or the other, but it's the fit that you're trying to do, not the balance. It will never balance.
Integration,
yes. So I look at it as work-life fit, and I'm feeding it in there in order to be successful in both work and life, which is important, work and family and business and personal life. And at the end of the day, I have to tell you that having three kids, having less time at work, has managed to make me prioritize better. And I can say that I'm more successful than I was in the past, which where I had a lot of hours to kill or to prepare, but it's kill mainly. And I used to prepare for my podcast and it took me 6 hours. Before I stopped my podcast, it used to take me 1 hour to prepare. It wasn't that I wasn't doing a good job, but I was spending too many hours at the office because I didn't have any obligations or as many obligations at home. But now I prioritize, I prepare my list from the previous evening because, as John Maxwell says, every day you're either preparing or repairing. You're either preparing for tomorrow or repairing yesterday because you failed to prepare. So this has helped me tremendously. Work-life fit, many plates to feed, many people to feed at the end of the day. It has helped me in my prioritization.
Maxwell has some fantastic proverbs, actually, and quotes. Yes, I love that one as well, preparing or repairing. The other one is, it's like, instead of saying, I'm going through some difficult project, I'm going to deliver the difficult project. So even the use of language.
Yes, yes, it has, yes, I love it.
We both have the three-kid formula, and I completely resonate with you. My opinion on the life balance, I've shared it before. I also wrote a blog post called The Balance Sheet of Life.
Yes,
I
remember that.
Yes, it's like I now think that the proper balance is to have a healthy set of responsibilities and a healthy set of rights or freedoms. So you want both, because if you are full of rights and luxuries and money and freedoms, but then you lose your direction. Too much freedom can be suffocating. You lose the directionality. You can go everywhere, so you freeze. On the other hand, if you have a plate full of burdens, responsibilities, bills, loans, you suffocate then. You succumb to the weight of the... So I think, in my view, the delegate balance and between the having a healthy set of responsibilities, listening to the elders as well, because they always say, have a family. Anyway, we live in different times now. And rights, gifts, charismas, and freedoms, then that's where the sweet spot lies.
True.
And I think that brought us to the end of the conversation. I'm so happy that we made it. We've been discussing about this for some time. And thank you for coming. It means a lot to me.
It's a pleasure. I have to congratulate you for the work you're doing, Philippos. And I told you many years ago when you took the decision to leave behind a six-figure salary, I told you that you will be adding a bonus into our industry. Because of your character, because of your ethics, because of your knowledge, which people can read in your book, and also they can see if they hang around with you. So it's an addition to our industry, a great asset into our industry. So I was very happy, and I am very happy. And thank you for the invitation.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Be well with everything.
Thank you. Likewise, my friend. Thank you.
My eyes, I stretch my soul to gather